Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris and you're watching Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Meta, the tech giant that owns Facebook, Instagram and WhatsApp, recently revealed that it had removed hundreds of accounts, pages and groups on its platforms, which it found to be part of a troll farm aimed at social media users in Malaysia. Meta said in its investigations, it found the troll farm to be linked to the Malaysian police. Now, to quote the Meta report, it said, this network manages pages, including those posing as independent news entities, and promoted the police while criticizing the opposition. Now, PDRM has since denied the claims. However, it begs the question of if and how homegrown disinformation operations pose a threat to Malaysian democracy. And where do we go from here? Joining us on the show, we have Dr. Ross Tapsell. He is a senior lecturer at Australian National University and director of the ANU's Malaysia Institute. His research focuses on the role of disinformation and social media campaigning in the democratic process, particularly within the Southeast Asian region. Ross, thanks so much for joining us on the show. I'm wondering, how did you first respond when you heard of claims of troll farms being linked to the Malaysian police? I mean, what do you make of this news?
Well, on the one hand, I think it's important not to give Facebook too much credit for this kind of revelations. There has been a lot of pressure on Facebook to try and expose some of this behavior over a long period of time. They're often slow or reluctant to do so. Obviously, the issue of trolling is a long entrenched practice in Southeast Asia. We've heard of trolls in the Philippines, of buzzers in Indonesia, and indeed of cyber troopers in Malaysia for quite some time. And these big platforms such as Twitter and Meta are rare that they expose this kind of behavior. So on the one hand, yes, it's good that there's this stuff out, but it's really only a tip of the iceberg in a lot of ways of what goes on their platforms, and they really should be doing more. So that was my first thought. And then the second thought was, of course, the role of the police itself and how this has become a regional issue. A couple of times Meta has exposed police operations in the Philippines previously, in government operations in Indonesia previously. And so we've now had this report, which includes allegedly the Malaysian police as well. So we are seeing this as a regional problem where the security apparatus is now actively involved in, I guess, manipulating the digital public sphere.
Ross, what do we know about those incidences in the Philippines and in Indonesia? Has anything come out from Facebook or from Meta revealing that there are links to security operations?
Yeah, so Meta publishes these reports. They say that there is, quote, coordinated inauthentic behavior, which basically means that there is a digital labor practice going on. And Meta in the Malaysia report said that we could tell this largely because, you know, it starts at 9 o'clock, there's a lunch break, it finishes at 5 p.m., which suggests you've got a team of people most likely employed pumping out certain forms of information, in this case, to be anti-opposition groups, pro-police kind of information. So they say that they've got the evidence for this. To what extent we get the details will be, usually they don't publish in great detail all of these kind of information, but sometimes Twitter and Meta does. And often what the response is from the security forces, for example, in the Philippines and indeed seemingly here in Malaysia, is just to deny that it doesn't go on. And in the case of the Philippines, they said, well, we just deny this kind of operation. Meta says, well, we've had the evidence. The evidence is there. Philippines police says we deny it. And then everybody moves on. So the problem here is, yeah, what is the recourse? Like, what happens next? Where is an independent arbitrator in this kind of example? And there doesn't seem to be one. They can just deny these things and then it goes on.
Okay, so kind of understanding a little bit about how cyber troopers work, and there seems to be this conversation happening about coordinated disinformation operatives. How do disinformants and cyber troopers or influence operations or whatever you want to call it, how do they impact the way people think and behave? Because the way Meta wrote in its report was that the idea was to manipulate or influence public discourse. Can troll farms do that? Is that are they effective in achieving that objective?
Yeah, so the practice of trolling or cyber trooping, whichever term we want to use, is actually very varied. Sometimes it's unpaid work through volunteer groups around election times, for example. Sometimes, I'm talking regionally here, sometimes it can be student groups that are part of a religious organization that receive small amounts of cash. Other times you're looking at highly structured, well-funded operations that include the state. And so the most famous case of this would be, again, in the Philippines, where you had these so-called pro-Duterte trolls who were constantly attacking opponents, including prominent female journalists and other activists, and constantly pumping out good information on Facebook and in comments on Facebook and Twitter and so on about the Duterte administration. And the argument that is put forward for those who write about trolls in the Philippines would be that it's largely state-sanctioned and state-funded. And I guess that's the concern that we might have here in Malaysia. To what extent is the state apparatus and political parties involved in pumping out good information about the government or the police or the security forces and attacking opponents in order to win over public sentiment on the digital public sphere? That's essentially what they're trying to do, flood out any criticism of powerful groups or, you know, the state, and make sure you're constantly saying good things about how the organization or the state works.
Can I ask you, with particularly with these political actors, do you think that in the case of Malaysia, with the upcoming general elections, will GE15 be fought mainly in the digital public sphere? Or do you think that social media is a poor bellwether for political engagement?
Yeah, I first started researching cyber troopers in the 2013 election. I thought it was a really interesting case. I thought actually Malaysia in some ways pioneered the practice, and then other countries started to adopt the methods. And then I thought by 2018, the practice had died out. I thought it was becoming really obvious when there were cyber troopers and political parties were employing them. You thought it was a really sort of old trick that wasn't working. And actually the most important discourse around the GE14 or the 2018 election was really WhatsApp and personalized communication, particularly around the 1MDB case, right, which was getting spread around on Facebook and WhatsApp. And that was issues of corruption and change of government was there. So for the next election, I still do think that WhatsApp is crucial. I do still think that individual politicians are going to want to hire digital media strategists. And indeed, some cases that will include teams of campaigners. And that might occur at a local level in their local constituencies, or it might be at a national level where the political parties try to have a top-down message that comes out to push out throughout the country. So I think digital campaigning matters. But what form it takes will be really interesting to see whether cyber trooping does actually impact much, or whether individualized messaging via WhatsApp is actually more crucial. We know that there's a practice where political parties try and hire people to get more people in WhatsApp groups and pushing this kind of message out. And indeed, we've seen the rise of TikTok over the past few years, and whether there's new practices on that platform. Overall, it's always an important strategy, but it's not the most important strategy to win an election.
Can I ask you if in your research you found that there are certain countries that are more susceptible to these types of digital campaigning or disinformation being spread digitally? I mean, what makes a population vulnerable to this type of digital campaigning?
Well, we certainly can't say that it's any particular country or, you know, education levels, for example. You know, it would be easy to have an answer like that and just say, oh, we just need better digital literacy, or we just need better literacy broadly. I mean, look at the challenges that the US is facing at the moment, and the January storming of the Capitol after the US election. I mean, clearly disinformation and social media discourse played a big role in convincing those people that the election was stolen and continuing to convince Americans who voted for Trump or Trump supporters that the election was stolen. So it's not a simple case of saying it's, you know, one country is more affected by the other, but obviously what you want in order to counter fake news and disinformation is a reliable media and mainstream media and a reliable public sphere, which includes quality independent journalism. And so part of the problem in the US is you don't have a lot of those kind of viewers who are, they're watching Fox News, they're on Facebook, and it does manipulate people. And that can be a challenge in every country, including my own in Australia.
I just assumed that, you know, I think the conversation about fake news from several years ago largely revolved around having more media literacy, having fact checkers, and that was the way to combat what we understand as fake news online. That's what I'm understanding from you now is not as simple as that. It's not just as simple as educating people to spot what is news and what is not news. And the reason why I ask this is because part of Meta's announcement was that the network had managed pages, including those posing as independent news entities. So what you know, a social media user might see as a news outlet without verifying it may think that this is coming from a reliable source. How do we expand that conversation beyond just media literacy? It feels like we want to do something, yet there doesn't seem to be, I think, proactive steps in addressing what has now become quite a widespread problem.
Yes, and I think some of the social media companies want an easy out here. They want to say we're funding fact checkers in Southeast Asia, right? You know, we're giving a bit of money here and there to fact checkers, and that'll help solve the problem. And if that was really the case, well, you know, why don't you give, you know, $10 million to fact checkers? Obviously, they have the money to do that. They're billion-dollar companies. They probably don't think that it's really that effective, but they want to look like they're doing something. Similarly, with sort of this broad thing about digital literacy, of course, literacy matters. Of course, having a broad awareness campaign around the nature of hoax news and disinformation matters. But there is a challenge if your digital literacy programs are run by the state itself, because the state tends to want to push its own agendas in these programs and tell you, well, all you need to do is watch government-sponsored TV shows or watch read government-affiliated newspapers. And so digital literacy programs, when you talk about education programs, are often run by the state. And if there's just state propaganda through these programs, doesn't solve the problem. So it's actually a really wide-ranging challenge. And ultimately, what we need is independent institutions, independent media, independent arbiters who can look at bringing people together from security forces, from PR companies, from advertising companies, and say, what is allowed? You know, what is standard practice and what is illegal practice when it comes to digital campaigning and digital advertising? And that's not being done at the moment.
Okay, so is regulation the way forward then?
And again, a highly dangerous path to go down, because as we know, you know, when you create an anti-fake news law, for example, it can easily become politicized and also really vaguely defined. You know, Malaysia is the classic case of this, of defining an anti-fake news law or defining fake news as news which is false or fake. And so who determines then? If you're going to let the government determine what is fake news, then ultimately they use that law in their own interests, or whoever is the party in power at the time might use that law to crack down on opposition figures or opponents. So there's a challenge there around regulation. But you can have, you know, regulation around this. We have defamation laws around the world that are useful. And so there is a place for regulation, but an anti-fake news law, a specific one, has proven to be problematic.
Ross, thank you so much for your time. Dr. Ross Tapsell, disinformation researcher and director of the Australian National University's Malaysia Institute. We're going to take a quick break here and consider this. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned. Hi, you're watching Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. Let's continue our conversation. Just a quick recap on the topic of tonight's show. The police have denied a claim by social media tech giant Meta that found that the PDRM was linked to a troll farm set up to manipulate public discourse. Now, the coordinated network was said to be active across Facebook, Instagram, TikTok and Twitter and had, quote, posted memes in Bahasa Malaysia in support of the current government coalition, along with claims of corruption among its critics, end quote. Now, what makes memes the weapon of choice for disinformants running influence campaigns? Let's ask University Nottingham graduate Farhan Shami Abdullah. He's our next guest. He is now an independent scholar who focuses on media literacy and digital cultures. In particular, he studies the Malaysian memescape. Farhan, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today. Farhan, memes, at a glance, I think of memes as harmless. They appear harmless. They seem to be more about humor and mischief. And, you know, there's a sense of playfulness. But increasingly, they are being used as tools of disinformation and they're being used in influence campaigns. Why do you think that is?
Yes. Okay. Thank you so much, Melissa. So first and foremost, I would like to just showcase how much memes have been explored in academics throughout the past few years. Yes, it is true that for the longest time, we've been looking at memes, funny pictures, they're harmless, they make you laugh, but we have never really looked into it as a form of cultural unit, as a form of cultural vehicle to move discursive sentiments from one place to another. So in talking about that, we must first consider what a meme is. So a meme is a group of content units that has been widely shared around, mimicked and altered, which spreads initially from one person to another. Then it expands until it becomes a cultural phenomenon. That's why when you look at the memes, when you look at like maybe SpongeBob, Baby the Frog, Star Wars, it comes from one person to another, and then suddenly everybody knows it. So it becomes a quintessential part of internet culture, where memes can indicate certain sentiments or feelings towards something that is being shared. So in effect, we often see these memes in the form of funny images, TikToks, Instagram. So think of, again, SpongeBob that has been altered to communicate messages based on the meme creator's desire. Think of funny and forthright amusing images of minions that has those good morning messages. And for the case of Malaysia, think of the Syukur Malaysia Masih Aman image macros and the Raja Bomo holding coconut memes that has been appropriated and used to talk about certain elements of politics in Malaysia.
All right. Can I ask you about memes? Because, again, you know, memes to me signify an internal joke, almost like an in-joke. I'm part of the joke because I understand the meme. So that in a way, it solidifies tribal bonds. And that can be a very persuasive digital tool to get people to spread a message because you want to be in on the joke. So you're asking what's behind this meme. Do you think that there are certain demographics in which memes penetrate or spread faster, particularly as we saw with the Meta announcement that these memes were in Malay, the text was in Malay, the text used within these memes were in Malay. Are there cultural sensitivities that we need to take into account when memes are being used in disinformation campaigns?
Yes, that's a good question, Melissa. So one of the things that we need to consider about memes is that it's a very youth-centric thing. One of the few elements that constructs a meme is the fact that it uses pop cultural references, it talks about events that are localized to a certain area and time. It also uses some lingo and words specific to demographics in that particular part. So in the case of Malaysia, we could certainly see how these memes were very strategic. The use of Malay is nowhere near a coincidence. The use of Malay by these troll farms was specifically used to influence Malay youth demographics who, when we look at where our country is headed, we're going into a shift in our polling where youths starting from 18 years old are coming in to vote for the first time. So this is exactly where these troll farms are trying to leverage. Not only is it something that carries people from a certain demographic in, it's also something that would that would influence people to join in on the joke. Because once you are part of the joke, something that's quite interesting about memes is that it's so easy to make one. In fact, Melissa, I could take 5 minutes and show you how to make a meme in online softwares. It's so easy for you to show certain sentiments and put in your own messages into those memes. So it then becomes a snowball effect from trolls that target youths in Bahasa Melayu to show specifically an illusion of grassroots support, to then people looking at it and say, oh, okay, maybe I want to be in on this joke. Maybe I feel strongly with the sentiment that's being put out by these memes. And then they contribute to that being further proliferated.
I think that's interesting what you just said, that memes are being used for the illusion of grassroots support. Can you elaborate on what you mean by that?
Yes. So this really brings into mind a form of warfare that's been quite debated in academics, which is called memetic warfare, which is the use of memes, humor, and popular culture by state actors or political entities to influence the narratives. So what we are seeing today from Meta's report is a shining example of what's happening in Malaysia. So they shut down a troll farm, which they claim was spreading state-linked propaganda. And these, especially when they use bots, it's hard for the average social media user to split whether or not they are real accounts or they are fake accounts, because bots are no longer those bots with random names and then random generated number, Mr. Coconut 6520. They are looking exactly like your friends. They are looking exactly like your average nation person. So this is where it's very dangerous, because memetic warfare is a very, very insidious form of narrative formation, where they use specific lingo and specific memes that are related to that particular demographic in skewing those opinions as if they are actual real opinions that are coming out from individuals.
Are there examples of where memetic warfare has taken place, where it's been effective in influencing discourse or maybe spreading influence about a certain information or political or state actor? Is there anywhere that you've seen or in your research that has been used as a case study?
Yes. Before I go on to the states, I would like to mention that NATO itself is looking to memetic warfare as a legitimate form of defense in countering misinformation and countering narratives that skew its defenses. As for solid examples of states that have been utilizing it, there's Israel and the IDF social media pages that's been used to show Israel in a good light and skew the view towards Palestine. There's ISIS and also Al-Qaeda that has been using memes to garner support for their movements. There's also Russia and Ukraine that's been using memes to garner support for their sides, altering a few truths here and there to show their particular side that this is what's going on, and that's how they get support. So troll farms have also been linked to China, Russia, and alt-right communities in America. We in Malaysia are also no stranger to bot farms, actually, as we could see Cyber Trooper link coordinated bots that surged during the previous 2018 election.
Are you concerned that it will be used again in the next general election? I mean, I spoke to Dr. Ross Tapsell a little bit earlier, and I asked him whether or not GE15 will be fought on the digital battleground. Do you think that this GE15 is largely going to be in the digital public sphere, and we as the citizenry and voters will be exposed to this memetic warfare? What is it that voters and social media users can do to kind of guard ourselves?
I would say most certainly this will be a facet of our upcoming general election. There has been these uses in the previous 2018 election, and it has shown to snowball support for different sites. So because it's worked already and it's working throughout the globe, I could certainly see this working, especially since memes are particularly resonate well with the youth that will become a new demographic. So how we are going to approach this in the next general election, it's important to then look at memes as a growing field, as a growing academic field. This then highlights exactly how important it is for us, the general society, academics, lawmakers, to look into memes and how they've been used in propaganda, especially important since Malaysia's discourse on memetic warfare and also memes in general is lagging behind. Governments and other organizations should seriously consider the impact and role of memes in disseminating these sort of content. But also for us as individuals, especially youths who are watching in, one of the main easy things that we could look into is to increase our own media literacy awareness. Because again, one of the things that bots are using to skew our perception towards certain areas is to highlight certain messages about, highlight a very, very specific form of messaging towards events. So what we can do is then scrutinize these events. Are you sure that this politician did that? Are you sure that this institution is going to bring you down? So these are the questions that we can have. We can have a very skeptical mindset to then question not only memes that are bringing these sorts of content, but also propaganda in general.
Farhan, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today. We've run out of time, but I'll tell you that I will never look at a meme, dismiss a meme, or look at a meme as the same way again. Thank you for your time. Independent scholar Farhan Shami Abdullah there, wrapping up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching, and good night.